So let's begin the evening with a little sitting. So, sitting up straight. I don't know where this idea comes from, whether it's originally something from Buddhism in Asia or something that was invented here in the West. I don't know, but there are four postures which are recognized as the four postures for meditation. This is classical, these four postures, which is sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. And sometimes I've seen these postures referred to as the four dignified postures. And I have no idea where the idea of the dignified postures comes from. Just somehow in the lore, in my travels, and I've heard about the four dignified postures. But as you start the sitting, you might think of your sitting posture as being dignified. Perhaps you can take a dignified but relaxed attitude or pose. With a sense of dignity. Sense of maybe nobility. Here you are. Taking a posture and a kind of way of being that's unapologetic. No need to apologize for who you are. Dignified, upright, present. And in the midst of this dignity, take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Breathing in deeply is a way of connecting to yourself, being present, respectful presence. Breathing in and then exhaling and relaxing as you exhale. Perhaps the exhale can be an expression of compassion or care, kindness to yourself. And letting your breath be normal. And take a few moments just to become familiar with how you are right now. Familiar with yourself, as if it's worthwhile. You're a worthwhile person to get to know. Familiarizing yourself with how your body is. The feelings and emotions that might be here. And the thoughts and concerns that might be here as well. as you exhale, perhaps with every exhale, letting go of your thoughts, even if it's just momentarily, so that as you exhale, relax, let go into a moment of silence, stillness. There's breathing, breathing in and breathing out. And then there's the knowing that you're breathing in and breathing out. human beings tend to take things very personally. Tend to take our body, our feelings, our thoughts, our opinions, our views. Taking things personally partly means we use these things to define who we are. We define ourselves through our body, bodily experiences, our health. We define ourselves by our feelings and emotions. We define ourselves with what we think about, our thoughts, our beliefs. Buddhism points to the possibility of not taking these things so personally, not using any of this stuff to define who you are. You're not your body, you're not your feelings, your thoughts, your emotions. But in the midst of your body, your feelings, your thoughts, there can be a quality of knowing, of awareness, that here is the sounds of my voice, that feels the stillness of the room. That knows the sensations of your body. There's something about knowing or awareness, quality or nature of awareness, that awareness does not need to define itself or define a self, doesn't need to take anything personally. But can hold all things within itself. Like awareness is a great big room, space, that can hold the objects of the space in the room. To rest in the peace of that knowing, in the peacefulness of awareness, an awareness that can hold all things within it. To rest in the peace of awareness is one of the things that helps make a person noble or dignified. There's a certain nobility of character, a certain kind of nobility of presence. That can hold all things. Without being ruffled. Without being swayed or pushed this way and that way. There's something about knowing, peaceful knowing, awareness, that is ennobling, ennobles, So, good evening. Welcome back to our third refuge class. And we talked a little bit about refuge in the Buddha and refuge in the Dharma. And today we'll talk a little bit about refuge in the Sangha and also about the precepts. And so the refuge in the Sangha, Buddham Saranam, Sangham Saranam Gacchami, I go for refuge to the Sangha. Sangha is one of the three jewels, one of the three refuges. And Sangha in Pali or in Sanskrit has a basic meaning of an assembly. I once saw a etymological or a kind of original meaning dictionary definition that it means a herd. But anyway, an assembly. And it was often used, it seems to have been often used in ancient India to refer to an assembly or a collection or a gathering or order of monastics. And even before Buddhism, there was an order of kind of any kind of renunciant. A class of people were called a gathering of Sangha. It seemed that the Buddha expanded the meaning of Sangha beyond, certainly beyond just including the monastic community. Sometimes he talked about the monastic Sangha, the Bhikkhu Sangha, but he also talked about something called the Savaka Sangha, or Shravaka in Sanskrit, which means the assembly of. Literally means the assembly of hearers, the people who actually heard his message, but not just heard it kind of casually. They were walking down the street and they heard it. But people really heard it enough that they were transformed or changed by the teachings, the practices that he had to teach. And so the Savaka Sangha is the people who are to some degree have witnessed or tasted or touched the liberation that the Buddha's teaching is pointing towards. And those people who form that assembly, assembly of the awakened people, were not only monastics, they also included lay people. So the Sangha, in its most formal sense, means when you take refuge in the Sangha, takes refuge in those people who have somehow or other tasted for themselves, touched for themselves, the liberation the Buddha was pointing towards. So they know, have first-hand experience of what this is about. And those people are sometimes called the noble ones. At least in the English translation, it's called that. It seems to be maybe one of the best ways of translating the word Arya into English as noble. Arya has very unfortunate connotations now. It's the same as Aryan. It's the same word. It just, you know, it's one of these, I don't know where exactly how it got to Nazi Germany, but it has these associations now that we don't usually. It'd be kind of odd if we kind of use the word literally, this Pali word into English, and come and become an Aryan. but what it had, the meaning, the context of the meaning back in ancient India, was someone who became ennobled, noble person. There was an Aryan race that came into India 5,000 years ago or so. They were kind of like the ruling race or the upper class race in much of India. And the Buddha was very critical of the kind of idea of castes and that how you were born defines who you are as a person. So he tended to redefine a lot of the terms of his times. So for example, a Brahmin was someone who was born into the caste, Brahmanical caste. And they had certain status in society because of how they were born. And the Buddha said, no, your status doesn't depend on how you're born. It depends on your conduct and how you live your life and the purity of your heart. And anybody can be a Brahmin if their heart is pure. And so the same thing with the redefinition of this word Arya, was rather than limiting it just to kind of this particular class of people who came down and invaded India 5,000 years ago, he redefined it so that it meant anybody who had, again, kind of purified their heart, who had been ennobled by the contact with the Dharma, with the purity, the freedom that comes from awareness. So it's sometimes called, in English, we call it the noble ones, the people who have been ennobled by the experience of freedom. So to take refuge in the Sangha is to somehow find refuge or inspiration or meaning in that there are people around you, people that you can meet who have somehow or other have tasted the truth of what the Buddha had to teach. It isn't an abstraction. It isn't just some kind of ideal that you can read about in texts and it's some lofty, you know, ideal. But this is actually something that people actually taste, experience, are transformed by when they're encountered with the Dharma. So to take refuge in the Sangha is somehow get support from these people, these possibilities. They kind of represent a possibility for all of us, and to know there are such people is very encouraging, very inspiring. And also such people are said to make very good guides. They can guide us to that possibility. They know what the possibility is, so they can kind of guide us in that direction. They know what's what. They can kind of point in that direction. They can recognize it in you, perhaps, if you have the experiences. So take refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha also means monastic community, and sometimes, occasionally, especially the monastics themselves, like to limit the term Sangha just for themselves. We're the Sangha, monks and nuns. And they're welcome to do that, as far as I'm concerned. They can do whatever they want. But sometimes it has its meaning, just means the monks and the nuns. And many times when people take refuge in Sangha, people often think that's what they're taking refuge in, is the order of monks and nuns. And I know I'm quite inspired by the ideal of the monastic order, the lifestyles that they live, the rules they live by, the intention of that life. It's a life of purity. It's a life of simplicity. It's a life that's really dedicated to purifying the heart. And it's kind of trying to live the life that the Buddha taught and the Buddha lived himself. I spent a little bit of time as a monk in Southeast Asia, and I was surprised, once I had the robes on, what a wonderful lifestyle it was, what a wonderful experience it was to be a monastic and to live according to the rules of the order, and have my mindfulness, my presence, everything kind of informed by these rules. It was very helpful. It's kind of like jump-starting or kind of accelerating my own spiritual growth to have that time. So some people like to take refuge in the Sangha. They represent a possibility of purity. And because nuns live under very strict rules, because of the rules, they have to live, at least behave, in a very pure way. For example, they're not allowed to handle money. So they can't go around hoarding it. And they can't go around stealing it or misusing it and something, because they're not supposed to have any. They're not supposed to hoard food. They're supposed to not have any food overnight. After 12 o'clock noon, they're not supposed to have any food in their possession. The next day, they just have to hope someone gives them more food. And so there's the idea of hoarding and holding and building things. You're not supposed to have many robes. So it's dedicated to a life of simplicity without it being ascetic. Buddhist monasticism is not meant to be ascetical. However, from the point of view of our lifestyle, it might seem that way, but it's meant to provide just enough of the care of the body requisites so we can be comfortable, but not any more so that we're burdened by all the requisites, you know. So you're not supposed to have a wardrobe of monastic robes, you know, and you're supposed to have at the most three, sometimes just one set, and to keep it really simple. And they're all supposed to basically look the same. So it isn't, you don't have the complication of having to look in your wardrobe and say, which robes do I wear today? You know, and go through the different colors and, you know, whatever, the styles you have there. And, oh no, they're out of style. You know, it was the style last year, but now it's not anymore. You know, the Buddhist monks' robes have been in style for 2,500 years. They're not going to go out of style soon. Some people think they look like you're wearing curtains. it's a life of simplicity. It's a life of of ethical purity to a high degree. Some people are quite inspired by that. This is possible to live this way. And so some people are so inspired by the monastic model that it encourages them in their practice. You know, I'm not going to become a monastic, but the fact that there are people who are living that lifestyle is very meaningful for me and very encouraging for me. And at least I can try to move in that direction or follow their example the best I can. For other people, Sangha means anybody they practice with. So taking refuge in Sangha means taking refuge in other people you practice with. So there are community here at IMC, your fellow practitioners, for example. It's really wonderful to have people to practice with. The analogy that's sometimes used is if you have a fire, bonfire, like campfire, with one log, it might burn somewhat, but it doesn't burn very well. But in order to have a big fire, you have to have a lot of logs piled up against each other. You need that support. You need them to kind of the heat, supporting each other. So in the same way with a practice, you can practice alone, but when you practice together with people, the fire, the enthusiasm, the strength of the practice tends to glow a lot stronger. And I know for me, I was very inspired to engage in Buddhist practice, my meditation practice, and did practice for a little while by myself, pretty much alone. But I would say that I never would have continued my practice. I never would have taken it as far as I did unless I had other people to practice with, other people who kind of were a little bit more senior with me in practice, who kind of knew the way a little bit, people who just showed up and were present and sat with me. The fact that they were sitting made me, I'll go sit with them, and made it a lot easier to sit. So other people who were figuring out new values to live by. Many times when people begin meditating, their sense of values and priorities begin to change. And sometimes those priorities or values put us at odds with our community or our colleagues or even our family sometimes. And it can be a real strain. Sometimes people might spend a lot of time gossiping or having harsh speech or critical speech. And after a while, you just don't want to do that kind of behavior anymore. And so you find it a little bit odd to be around your place of work where that kind of language is being spoken all the time. And you feel like the odd person out. Or perhaps, I know some people who've been in work situations who are highly competitive in kind of mean-spirited ways, and they just find that they couldn't participate in that kind of competition anymore because their values were changing when they were doing this practice. So it's really helpful sometimes, if you're being changed by the practice, to have other people around you who also share those values, so that you don't think you're going crazy, you don't think you're the only one and you can't do it. And so to have a community of practitioners to be with, have some contact with, from I think most people is very, very important. Different people decide how much that contact is. Some people like to do a lot, some people just a little bit, just have some contact. But to have some contact with a community of people is very helpful. I've practiced in places like Tassajara or monasteries in different places, or a Spirit Rock. I know these all places where I've heard people say this, where people live far away. Sometimes they live, way up, in the middle of, some isolated community far out in the wildernesses of America, Iowa or something, and there's no one meditates there. There's no Buddhist there, or no nothing there, but they're somehow interested in this practice. And they know that Spirit Rock exists. They know that people are practicing at Spirit Rock. They know that Tassajara exists. They know people are practicing there. And that gives them so much encouragement. And it's so meaningful for them. Even though they don't have direct personal contact with other people who practice, the fact that there are people who are doing it in a concentrated way means so much for them and keeps them going in their isolation. It's wonderful to have a community of practitioners to bump up against. Sometimes practicing in a community of other people, it's said to be begins to rub off our sharp edges, rounds us off a little bit, rounds us out. It's wonderful because when you're in community of people, who are also practicing, sometimes you can see yourself much better. And actually, the first my first motivation to go and practice in a community of a Buddhist center was I've been practicing some time, and I would visit the Zen Center in San Francisco, and I noticed that when I went there, that the usual kind of social games that I played in my conversations with people, the way I wanted to build myself up or be seen or recognized or whatever, just wasn't reciprocated in any kind of way by some of the people there. I would say what I used to do, and there would be no response. And I felt like I was a mirror, you know. I was forced to see what I was doing. And when I was with my friends back home, you know, we were all in the same game, we all played the same games, you know, and we just would, you know, do all the stuff, right? And we had a glorious time, or not. And I was really struck that when I went to this community, that these people operated as mirrors for me. I don't know if it was intentional on their part, but, you know, I just those games, you know, didn't meet anything. And so I got to see myself a lot better. So that seeing yourself is very helpful. Having a community of people where you feel safe is very, very helpful. And the idea of a practice community, at least in the ideal, is it's a safe community. My hope is any Buddhist community, including ours at IMC, is a place where no one's ever turned away. No one's ever kind of shunned from our hearts. No matter how difficult a person is or how much tension there might be, that the tension and difficulties have some place where we respect it, and we have some place to deal with it or work with it or hold it. But we're not going to turn away from people or turn them away because of who they are or what's going on. So no matter how much the conflict is, you know, the commitment at least of the Buddhist community, okay, let's see how we can work with this. Let's see how we can include this as part of our practice. So I find it very inspiring to be around people like that. And it's very helpful for me in my practice, and I think helpful for a lot of people, to take refuge, take support in a community of people who are practicing. Now, people who are practicing are fallible. People who, you know, and so, you know, what it said is, until you're enlightened, some degree of awakening, you're liable to make all kinds of mistakes, all kinds of, you know, problems. And so it's very important then that the practice community kind of can hold those problems in a healthy way. So because of that, that's why some people say, well, the ultimate refuge is not the practice community, is not the monastic community, because not by far, not all monastics are awakened. But rather, it's really the essential sangha, the essential sangha you take refuge in, are those people who have somehow touched awakening. Because they know what it's about. They've been changed, they've been purified by that experience. The idea of awakening in Buddhism is awakening, in a sense, is not for its own sake. Sometimes we think awakening is the ultimate goal or something. But in Buddhism, it's more that awakening is important, but awakening is important because it has a function. And the function is it purifies the heart. It purifies the heart of its greed, hate, and delusion. It purifies the heart of its attachments and clingings and fears. And it's that purification of attachments which is the important thing, more so than the experience of awakening itself. Or maybe the two can't be separated so much. But because awakening and purification are so closely connected, someone who's touched awakening has also touched, somehow been transformed or changed to some degree by the purifying forces of that awakening. So those people, it said, you can trust. Those people are places you can go for refuge. So far I've given you three meanings of sangha. One is this community of awakened people. The other is monastic community. And then the third is the community of people you practice with, fellow practitioners. And then there's a fourth meaning, which sometimes appears, especially in the modern West. And that is, sangha refers to all living beings. And it's a beautiful sentiment because it's some idea that somehow we live in community, in family, with everything that's alive. And so there's a kind of a very strong sense of interconnectedness. And so we take refuge in that interconnectedness, or refuge in the fact that we're all family together. And So for some people that's very meaningful, that sense of this large extended community we're part of all living beings. One of the things I like about that is that in the Buddhist circles that I've been in, there's a very soft, to the point of being sometimes invisible, boundary between the Buddhists and those who are not. I mean, it's kind of like that's not so important for Buddhists, that's, you know, that we're Buddhist or people are Buddhist or whatever. And so the idea is that all living beings is our sangha, is our spiritual community, not just the Buddhists, not just our fellow practitioners, but extends out to all people. Some people narrow it a little bit, not just extend it beyond Buddhists, but short, but don't include all living things, but say the sangha is all people who are trying to live a life of truth, trying to live the Dharma or live the truth or live a spiritual life. So there's a variety of meanings that sangha has for people. So so kind of then to change a little bit the direction of what I'm talking about. And when I was about 20, I was given the opportunity, which I took, to sail across the Atlantic on a sailboat. And but the thing was that we were a little bit late in getting going because of engine problems. So by the time we left the eastern Atlantic, it was the beginning of the hurricane season. And the advantage of that is that there's really good winds in the summertime across the Atlantic. So if you get across quickly. In the wintertime, the winds aren't so good for crossing by the equator, so southern Atlantic. And so the plan we had was, there are these places in the middle Atlantic that are called the Hurricane Islands or something like that. And they've tracked hurricanes for many years. And there are certain spots in the Atlantic, between Africa and the Caribbean there, where they've never recorded a hurricane. Hurricanes never started there or gone through there or anything. And so they don't know why, but they thought, well, there's these kind of little pockets of safety. So since we were sailing in the hurricane season, we thought, well, we'll just zigzag across the Atlantic, you know, to these little, you know, hurricane-free spots, and you know, kind of try to stay in their safety. And maybe I should just stop with that story, just, you know, and then make the analogy that, you know, kind of like we need some places of safety to go, some place of refuge from the storms. And so the idea is that the triple refuge in Buddhism is a refuge, a place you can go when life is in crisis or tumultuous or difficult. Sometimes even when you don't even know how to manage on your own, you don't know what to do necessarily. But you have a place to go where you feel, you know, it's a refuge, a place of relief, a place of being reassured, a place of having some place of confidence. Something provides something to us. So the refuges are meant to be part that in times of difficulty or times when we want to be inspired, that we have this place, we know where we can go. Now, the part of the story I left out about the hurricane islands in the Atlantic was that summer, the first hurricane in the season started in one of those islands, one of those hurricane holes. So the analogy breaks down. So the idea of taking refuge in Sangha brings to mind to me, I'm just, this kaleidoscope in my mind now, all these people, practitioners and people that I've known through my life, who were so meaningful for me along the way, who somehow taught me or showed me a possibility that inspired me and moved me and changed who I was. And it's all kinds of different levels, that ways in which that happened. But the one that stands out the strongest for me at this moment is when I was at the Zen monastery in Tassajara. And I was walking around the monastery. And in the distance, I saw one of the monks there walking across the courtyard to go to his job in the kitchen. He worked in the kitchen. And what I saw when I saw him there was this classic kind of Zen thing. Here was someone who was just walking. He was walking to walk. In a sense, he had some place to go, but also he had nowhere to go. I saw someone who was just at peace with himself at that situation. Nothing needed to happen. Nowhere to go, nothing to get to, no one to be. I have no idea that was really going on in our post-Freudian world. We might call it projection on my part. I don't know. But there was something about the way he was at that moment that was very, very meaningful for me. And it pointed me to a possibility that I could also be that way. I didn't have to be anybody for anybody. I didn't have to get anything or attain anything. I didn't have to accomplish anything. I didn't have to, I could just, this very moment here, just to be alive is enough. Just this here, this moment, to become fully here and at peace with this moment. And so that was one example of, very meaningful moment to me of being together with another practitioner, another person who really kind of awoke something inside of me that I think in some ways changed me for the rest of my life. So, now I think it's your turn to explore a little bit together your own thoughts about refuge in the Sangha. What meaning could this refuge have for you, or what meaning does Sangha mean for you? If you're going to be in the ceremony and take refuge in the Sangha, what would you like that to mean for yourself? What does it mean? How do you fill it with meaning or purpose or value for yourself, taking refuge in the Sangha? How do you want to understand Sangha? And how do you understand what it means to take refuge in Sangha? What does that mean for you? It's a kind of vague word, refuge. You become a refugee. And what does it mean to take refuge for you? So there's two questions. What does it mean for you, this Sangha? What does it mean to take refuge in Sangha? What does that mean? So I'd like to propose the same as the last 2 weeks, that maybe groups of four. And maybe we'll take about 15 minutes or so for the groups of four to talk. And then I'll ring the bell and we'll continue. Does that seem okay?